Isn't she entitled to a normal kid's life, just like your Justin?
But it's dangerous and—
Not while we're around, it isn't, he assured her. She just turned away.
Justin!
Her son turned to see his mother holding his jacket. He paused for a second, and with one finger pushed the blocks a fraction of an inch, waiting for the 4-foot pile to teeter over like a falling tree. Budding engineer, Russell heard through his earpiece. I'll check her tag number. He nodded to the female agent in the doorway. In 20 minutes they'd have a new dossier to look over. Probably it would just say that Mrs. Walker was a new-age pain in the ass, but if she had a history of mental problems, possible, or a criminal record, unlikely, it would be something to remember. He scanned the room automatically, then shook his head. Sandbox was a normal kid surrounded by normal kids. At the moment, she was crayoning a blank sheet of paper, her face screwed into a look of intense concentration. She'd been through a normal day, a normal lunch, a normal nap, and soon would have an abnormal trip back to a decidedly abnormal home. She hadn't noticed the discussion he'd just had with Justin's mother. Well, kids were smart enough to be kids, which was more than one could say for a lot of their parents. Mrs. Walker guided her son to the family car, a Volvo wagon to no one's surprise, where she dutifully strapped him into the safety seat in the back. The agent memorized the tag number for processing, knowing that it would turn nothing of real importance, and knowing that they'd run it anyway, because there was always the off chance that... It all came back just then, the reason why they had to be careful. Here they were, at Giant Steps, the same daycare center the Ryans had used since Shadow was a munchkin, just off Ritchie Highway above Annapolis. The bad guys had used the 7-Eleven just across the road to stake out the location, then followed Surgeon in her old Porsche, using a custom van. And on the Route 50 bridge, they'd pulled off a sweet little ambush, and later killed a state trooper in their escape. Dr. Ryan had been pregnant with Shortstop then. Sandbox had been far off into a future yet undreamed of at the time. All of this had a strange effect on Special Agent Marcella Hilton. Unmarried, again, she was twice divorced with no kids of her own, being around kids had made her heart flutter a little, tough professional that she was. She figured it was part of her hormones, or the way the female brain was wired, or maybe she just liked kids and wished she had one of her own. Whatever it was, the thought that people could deliberately hurt little kids made her blood chill for a brief moment, like a blast of cold wind that came and went. This place was too vulnerable. And there really were people out there who didn't care a rat's ass about hurting kids. And that 7-Eleven was still there. There were 6 agents on the sandbox detail now. That would be down to 3 or 4 in a couple of weeks. The service wasn't the all-powerful agency people thought it was. Oh, sure, it had a lot of muscle, and investigative clout which few suspected. Alone of the federal police forces, the United States Secret Service could knock on somebody's door and walk in and conduct a friendly interview with someone who might represent a threat, an assumption based on evidence which might or might not be usable in a court of law. The purpose of such an interview would be to let the person know that he or she had an eye fixed firmly on him or her, and though that wasn't strictly true, the service had only about 1,200 agents nationwide, the mere thought of it was enough to scare the hell out of people who'd said the wrong thing into the wrong ear. But those people weren't the threat. As long as the agents did their job correctly, the casual threat wasn't a deadly one. Those people almost always tipped their hand, and people like her knew what to look for. It was the ones their intelligence division didn't hear about who constituted the real threat. Those could be deterred somewhat through a massive show of force, but the massive show was too expensive, too oppressive, too obvious not to attract notice and adverse comment. Even then, she remembered another event, months after the near death of Surgeon, Shadow, and the yet unborn shortstop. A whole squad, she thought. It was a case study at the Secret Service Academy at Beltsville. The Ryan House had been used to film a recreation of the event. Chuck Avery, a good, experienced supervisory agent, and his whole squad taken out. As a rookie, she'd watched the taped analysis of what had gone wrong, and even then she'd chilled at how easy it had been for that team to make a small mistake, that to be compounded by bad luck and bad timing. Yeah, I know. She turned to see Don Russell, sipping from a plastic coffee cup while he got some fresh air. Another agent was on post inside.
Did you know Avery?
He was 2 years ahead of me at the academy. He was smart and careful, and a damn good shot. He dropped one of the bad guys then, in the dark from 30 yards, 2 rounds in the chest. A shake of the head. You don't make little mistakes in this business, Marcy. That is when the second chill came, the one that made you want to reach for your weapon, just to be sure that it was there, to tell yourself that you were ready to get the job done. That's when you remembered, in this case, how cute a little kid could be, and how even if you took the hits, you'd make damn sure your last conscious act on the planet would be to put every round through the bastard's X-ring. Then you blinked, and the image went away. She's a beautiful little girl, Don.
I've rarely seen an ugly one, Russell agreed.
This was the time when one was supposed to say, "Don't worry, we'll take good care of her." But they didn't say that. They didn't even think it. Instead, they looked around at the highway and the trees and the 7-Eleven across Ritchie Highway, wondering what they'd missed, and wondering how much money they could spend on surveillance cameras. George Winston was used to being met. It was the ultimate perk, really. You got off the airplane, almost always an airplane in his case, and there was somebody to meet you and take you to the car whose driver knew the quickest way to where you were going. No hassles with Hertz and figuring the useless little maps out and getting lost. It cost a lot of money, but it was worth it, because time was the ultimate commodity. And you were born with only so much to spend, and there was no passbook to tell you the exact amount. The Metroliner pulled into Union Station's Track 6. He'd gotten some reading done and had himself a nice nap between Trenton and Baltimore. A pity the railroad couldn't make money carrying passengers, but you didn't have to buy air to fly in, while it was necessary to build a right-of-way for ground transport. Too bad. He collected his coat and briefcase and headed for the door, tipping the first-class attendant on the way out. "Mr. Winston?" a man asked.
"That's right."
The man held up a leather ID holder, identifying himself as a federal agent. He had a partner, Winston noted, standing 30 feet away with his topcoat unbuttoned.
"Follow me, please, sir."
With that, they were merely 3 more busy people heading off to an important meeting. There were many such dossiers, each of them so large that the data had to be edited so as not to overflow the file cabinets, and it was still more convenient to do it with paper than a computer, because it was hard to get a computer that worked well in his native language. Checking up on the data would not be difficult. For one thing, there would be more press coverage to confirm or alter what he had. For another, he could confirm a lot very simply, merely by having a car drive past a few places once or twice, or by observing roads. There was little danger in that. However careful and thorough the American Secret Service might be, they were not omnipotent. This Ryan fellow had a family, a wife who worked, children who went to school, and Ryan himself had a schedule he had to keep. In their official home they were safe. Reasonably so, he corrected himself, since no fixed place was ever truly safe. But that safety did not follow them everywhere, did it? It was more than anything else a matter of financing and planning. He needed a sponsor.
"How many do you need?" the dealer asked.
"How many do you have?" the prospective buyer asked.
"I can get 80, certainly.
Perhaps 100, the dealer thought aloud, sipping at his beer.
"When?" A week will suffice?
They were in Nairobi, capital of Kenya, and a major center for this particular trade.
Biological research?
Yes, my client's scientists have a rather interesting project underway.
What project might that be? The dealer asked.
That I am not at liberty to say, was the not unexpected answer.
Nor would he say who his client was.
The dealer didn't react, and didn't particularly care. His curiosity was human, not professional.
If your services are satisfactory, we may be back for more.
The usual enticement. The dealer nodded and commenced the substantive bargaining.
You must understand that this is not an inexpensive undertaking. I must assemble my people. They must find a small population of the creature you desire. There are the problems of capture and transport, export licenses, the usual bureaucratic difficulties.
By which he meant bribes. Trade in African green monkeys had picked up in the last few years. Quite a few companies used them for various experimental purposes. That was generally bad for the monkeys, but there were a lot of monkeys. The African green was in no way endangered, and even if they were, the dealer didn't especially care. Animals were a national resource for his country, as oil was for the Arabs, to be marketed for hard currency. He didn't get sentimental about them. They bit and spat, and were generally unpleasant little beggars, cute though they might appear to the tourists at treetops. They also ate the crops tended by the numerous small farmers in the country, and were thoroughly detested for that reason, whatever the game wardens might say.
These problems are not strictly our concern. Speed is. You will find that we are willing to reward you handsomely in return for reliable service.
Ah. The dealer finished his beer and, lifting his hand, snapped his fingers for a refill. He named his price. It included his overhead, pay to the gatherers, the customs people, a policeman or two, and a mid-level government bureaucrat, plus his own net profit, which, in the terms of the local economy, was actually quite fair, he thought. Not everyone did.
Agreed, the buyer said, without so much as a sip of his soft drink.
It was almost a disappointment. The dealer enjoyed haggling, so much a part of the African marketplace. He'd scarcely begun to depose on how difficult and involved his business was.
A pleasure doing business with you, sir. Call me in 5 days.
The buyer nodded. He finished his drink and took his leave. 10 minutes after that he made a call, the third such communication to the embassy in the day, and all for the same purpose. Though he didn't know it, yet more such calls had been made in Uganda, Zaire, Tanzania, and Mali.
Jack remembered his first time in the Oval Office, the way you shuffled left to right from the secretary's room through what turned out to be a molded door set in a curved wall, much in the manner of an 18th-century palace, which the White House actually was, if a modest one in the context of the times. You tended to notice the windows first of all, especially on a sunny day. Their thickness made them look green, rather like the glass walls of an aquarium designed for a very special fish. Next you saw the desk, a large wooden one. It was always intimidating, all the more so if the president was standing there waiting for you. All this was good, the president thought. It made his current job all the easier.
"George," Ryan said, extending his hand.
"Mr. President," Winston responded pleasantly, ignoring the two Secret Service agents standing immediately behind him, there to grab him if he did something untoward. He didn't have to hear them. The visitor could feel their eyes on the back of his neck, rather like laser beams. He shook Ryan's hand anyway and managed a crooked smile. Winston didn't know Ryan very well. They'd worked together well during the Japanese conflict. Previously, they'd bumped into each other at a handful of minor social functions, and he knew of Ryan's work in the market, discreet but effective. All that time in the intelligence business hadn't been entirely wasted.
"Sit down,"
Jack waved to one of the couches.
"Relax.
How was the trip down?"
"The usual."
A Navy mess steward appeared seemingly from nowhere and poured 2 cups of coffee, because it was that time of the day. The coffee, he found, was excellent, and the china exquisite with its gold trim.
"I need you," Ryan said next.
"Sir, look, there was a lot of damage done to my
country."
"I've never wanted a government job, Jack," Winston replied at once, speaking rapidly. Ryan didn't even touch his cup.
"Why do you think I want you?"
"George, I've been there and done that, okay? More than once. I have to put a team together. I'm going to give a speech tonight. You might like what I'm going to say."
"Okay, first I need somebody to run Treasury. Defense is okay for the moment. State's in good hands with Adler. Treasury is first on my list of things that have to be filled with somebody new. I need somebody good. You're it."
"Are you clean?" Ryan asked abruptly.
"What?"
"Bet your ass I am. I made all my money within the rules. Everybody knows that."
Winston bristled until he realized that he was expected to.
"Good. I need somebody who has the confidence of the financial community.
You do.
I need somebody who knows how the system really works.
You do.
I need somebody who knows what's broke and needs fixing and what isn't and doesn't.
You do.
I need somebody who isn't political.
You aren't.
I need a dispassionate pro. Most of all, George, I need somebody who's going to hate his job as much as I hate mine."
"What exactly do you mean by that, Mr. President?"
Ryan leaned back for a second and closed his eyes before going on. "I started working inside when I was 31. I got out once, and I did okay on the street, but I got sucked back, and here I am." The eyes opened. "Ever since I started with the agency, I've had to watch how things work on the inside, and guess what? I never did like it. I started on the street, remember, and I did okay then, too, remember? I figured I'd become an academic after I made my pile. History's my first love, and I thought I'd teach and study and write, figure out how things worked and pass my knowledge along. I almost made it, and maybe things didn't work out that way exactly, but I've done a lot of studying and learning. So, George, I'm going to put a team together."
"To do what?"
"Your job is to clean up Treasury. You've got monetary and fiscal policy."
"You mean..."
"Yes."
"No political bullshit?"
He had to ask that.
"Look, George, I don't know how to be a politician, and I don't have time to learn. I never liked the game. I never liked most of the people in it. I just kept trying to serve my country as best I could. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. I didn't have a choice.
You remember how it started. People tried to kill me and my family. I didn't want to get sucked in, but goddammit, I learned that somebody has to try to get the job done. I'm not going to do it alone anymore, George, and I'm not going to fill all the vacant posts with ticket punchers who know how to work the system, okay? I want people with ideas in here, not politicians with agendas."
Winston set his cup down, managing not to rattle the saucer as he did so. He was a little surprised that his hand wasn't shaking. The length and breadth of what Ryan proposed was quite a bit more than the job which he'd had every intention of declining. It would mean more than was obvious. He'd have to cut himself off from his friends. Well, not really. But it meant that he would not make executive decisions based on what campaign contributions the street would give the president as a result of the nice things that Treasury did for the trading houses up there. That's the way the game had always been played, and though he'd never been a player, he'd talked often enough with those who were, working the system in the same old way, because that was how things were.
"Shit," he whispered half to himself.
"You're serious, aren't you?"
As founder of the Columbus Group, he'd assumed a duty so basic that few ever thought about it, beyond those who actually undertook it. And not always enough of them. Literally millions of people, directly or indirectly, entrusted their money to him, and that gave him the theoretical ability to be a thief on the cosmic scale. But you couldn't do that. For one thing, it was illegal, and you ran the risk of rather substandard federal housing as a result of it, with very substandard neighbors to boot. But that wasn't the reason you didn't. The reason was that those were people out there,
and they trusted you to be honest and smart. And so you treated their money the same as you treated your own, or maybe even a little better, because they couldn't gamble the way a rich man did.
Every so often you'd get a nice letter from some widow, and that was nice, but it really came from inside. Either you were a man of honor, or you were not. And honor, some movie writer had once said, was a man's gift to himself. Not a bad aphorism, Winston told himself. It was also profitable, of course. You did the job in the right way, and chances were that people would reward you for it. But the real satisfaction was playing the game well. The money was merely a result of something more important, because money was transitory, but honor wasn't.
Tax policy? Winston asked. We need Congress put back together first, remember, Ryan pointed out. But, yes.
Winston took a deep breath.
That's a very big job, Ryan.
You're telling me that? The president demanded, then grinned.
It won't make me any friends.
You also become head of the Secret Service. They'll protect you, won't they, Andrea? Agent Price was not used to being pulled into these conversations, but she feared she'd have to get used to it.
Yes, Mr. President.
Things are just so damned inefficient, Winston observed.
So fix it, Ryan told him.
It might be bloody.
Buy a mop.
I want your department cleaned up, streamlined, and run like you want it to make a profit someday. How you do that is your problem. For defense, I want the same thing. The biggest problem over there is administrative. I need somebody who can run a business and make a profit to cull the bureaucracy out. That's the biggest problem of all for all the agencies.
You know Tony Brentano?
The TRW guy?
He used to run their satellite division.
Ryan remembered his name as a former candidate for a senior Pentagon post, which offer he'd turned down flat. A lot of good people declined such offers. That was the paradigm he had to break.
Lockheed Martin is going to steal him away in a couple weeks. At least that's what my sources tell me. That's why Lockheed's stock is nudging up. We have a buy advisory on it. He gave TRW a 50% profit increase in 2 years. Not bad for an engineer who isn't supposed to know beans about management. I play golf with him sometimes. You should hear him scream about doing business with the government.
Tell him I want to see him.
Lockheed's board is giving him a free hand to...
That's the idea, George.
What about my job? I mean, what you want me to do? The rule is...
I know. You'll be acting secretary until we get things put back together.
Winston nodded.
Okay. I need to bring a few people down with me.
I'm not going to tell you how to do it. I'm not even going to tell you all the things you have to do. I just want it to get done, George. You just have to tell me ahead of time. I don't want to read about it in the papers first.
When would I start?
The office is empty right now, Ryan told him.
A final hedge.
I have to talk to my family about it.
You know, George, these government offices have phones and everything.
Jack paused.
Look, I know what you are. I know what you do. I might have turned out the same way, but I just never found it satisfactory, I guess, just to make money. Getting startups off the ground, that was something different.
Okay, managing money is important work. I didn't like it myself, but I never wanted to be a doctor either.
Fine, different strokes and all that.
But I know you've sat around a lot of tables with beer and pretzels talking about how screwed up this town is.
Here's your chance. It will never come again, George.
Nobody will ever have an opportunity to be Sec-Trez without political considerations. Never. You can't turn it down because you'd never forgive yourself if you did.
Winston wondered how one could be so adroitly cornered in a room with curved walls.
You're learning the political stuff, Jack.
Andrea, you have a new boss, the president told his principal agent.
For her part, Special Agent Price decided that Callie Weston might be wrong after all.
The notice that there would be a presidential address tonight upset a carefully considered timetable,
but only by a day. More of concern was the coordination of that event with another. Timing was everything in politics, as much as in any other field, and they'd spent a week working on this. It wasn't the usual illusion of experts moving with practiced skill. There had never been practice in this particular exercise. It was all guesses, but they'd all made guesses before, and mostly good ones. Else Edward J. Keelty would never have risen as far as he had. But like compulsive gamblers, they never really trusted the table or the other players, and every decision carried with it a lot of ifs. They even wondered about right and wrong on this one. Not the right and wrong of a political decision, the considered calculation of who would be pleased and who offended by a sudden stand on the principle du jour, but whether or not the action they were contemplating was objectively correct, honest, moral. And that was a rare moment for the seasoned political operatives. It helped that they'd been lied to, of course. They knew they'd been told lies. They knew he knew that they knew that he'd lied to them, but that was an understood part of the exercise. To have done otherwise would have violated the rules of the game. They had to be protected so long as they did not break faith with their principal, and being protected from adverse knowledge was part of that covenant.
"So you never really resigned, Ed?" his chief of staff asked. He wanted the lie to be clear so that he could tell everyone that it was the Lord's truth to the best of his knowledge. "I still have the letter," the former senator and former vice president, and that was the rub, replied, tapping his jacket pocket. "Brett and I talked things over, and we decided that the wording of the letter had to be just so, and what I had with me wasn't quite right. I was going to come back the next day with a new one, dated properly, of course, and it would have been handled quietly. But who would have thought? You could just, well, forget about it." This part of the dance had to be stepped out in accordance with the music. "I wish I could," Keelty said after a moment's sincere pause, followed by a concerned, passionate voice. This was good practice for him, too. "But, dear God, the shape the country's in! Ryan's not a bad guy. Known him for years. He doesn't know crap about running a government, though." "There's no law on this, Ed. None. No constitutional guidance at all, and even if there were, no Supreme Court to rule on it." This came from Keelty's chief legal adviser, formerly his senior legislative aide. "It's strictly political." "It won't look good," he had to say next. "It won't look..." "That's the point," the chief of staff noted. "We're doing this for apolitical reasons, to serve the interests of the country. Ed knows he's committing political suicide." To be followed by instant and glorious resurrection live on CNN. Keelty stood and started walking around the room, gesturing as he spoke. "Take politics out of this, damn it. The government's been destroyed. Who's going to put it back together? Ryan's a goddamn CIA spook. He knows nothing about government operations. We have a Supreme Court to appoint, policy to carry out. We have to get Congress put back together. The country needs leadership, and he doesn't have a clue on how to do that. I may be digging my own political grave, but somebody has to step up and protect our country." Nobody laughed. The odd thing was that it never occurred to them to do so. The staffers, both of whom had been with EJK for 20 years or more, had so lashed themselves to this particular political mast that they had no choice in the matter. This bit of theater was as necessary as the passage of the chorus in Sophocles, or Homer's invocation of the muse. The poetics of politics had to be observed. It was about the country, and the country's needs, and Ed's duty to the country over a generation and a half, because he'd been there and done it for all that time, knew how the system worked, and when it all came down, only a person like he could save it. The government was the country, after all. He'd spent his professional lifetime devoted to that proposition. They actually believed all that,
and no less than the two staffers, Keelty was lashed to the same mast. How much he was responding to his own ambition, even he could no longer say, because belief becomes fact after a lifetime of professing it. The country occasionally showed signs of drifting away from his beliefs, but as an evangelist has no choice but to entreat people back to the true faith, so Keelty had a duty to bring the country back to its philosophical roots, which he espoused for 5 terms in the Senate, and a briefer time as vice president. He'd been called the conscience of the Senate for more than 15 years, so named by the media, which loved him for his views and his faith and his political family. It would have been well for him to consult the media on this call, as he'd done often enough in the past, briefing them on a bill or amendment, asking their views. The media loved for people to ask their opinion on things, or just making sure they came to all the right parties. But not in this case. No, he couldn't do that. He had to play everything straight. The appearance of currying favor could not be risked, whereas the deliberate avoidance of that maneuver would give the patina of legitimacy to his actions. High-minded. That was the image to project. He'd forego all of the political tapestry for the first time in his life, and in so doing embroider a new segment. The only thing to consider now was timing, and that was something his media contacts could help with. "What time?" Ryan asked. 8:30 Eastern," Van Damme replied. "There are a couple of specials tonight, sweeps week, and they've asked us to accommodate them." Ryan might have growled about that, but didn't. His thoughts showed clearly on his face anyway. "It means you get a lot of West Coast people on their car radios," Arnie explained. "We have all 5 networks, plus CNN and C-SPAN. That's not a given, you know. It's a courtesy. They don't have to let you on at all. They play that card for political speeches." "Damn it, Arnie, this isn't political. It's..." "Mr. President, get used to it, okay? Every time you take a leak, it's political. You can't escape that. Even the absence of politics is a political statement." Arnie was working very hard to educate his new boss. He listened well, but he didn't always hear. "Okay, the FBI says I can release all of this?" "I talked to Murray 20 minutes ago. It's okay with him. I have Callie incorporating that in the speech right now." She could have had a better office. As the #1 presidential speechwriter, she could have asked for and gotten a gold-plated personal computer sitting on a desk of Carrara marble. Instead, she used a 10-year-old Apple Macintosh Classic, because it was lucky, and she didn't mind the small screen. Her office might have been a closet or storeroom once upon a time, back when the Indian Treaty Room had really been used for Indian treaties. The desk had been made at a federal prison, and while the chair was comfortable, it was 30 years old. The room had high ceilings. That made it easier for her to smoke, in violation of federal and White House rules, which were in her case not enforced. The last time someone had tried to muscle her, a Secret Service agent really had been forced to pull her off the male staffer lest she scratch his eyes out. That she had not been terminated at once was a sign to the rest of the personnel in the old executive office building. Some staff people could not be touched. Callie Weston was one of those. There were no windows in her room. She didn't want them. For her, reality was her computer and the photographs on her walls. One was of her dog, an aging English sheepdog named Holmes. Oliver Wendell, not Sherlock. She admired the prose of the Yankee from Olympus, an accolade she accorded few others. The rest were of political figures, friends and enemies, and she studied them constantly. Behind her was a small TV and VCR, the former usually tuned to C-SPAN 1 or 2 or CNN, and the latter used to review tapes of speeches written by others and delivered in all manner of places. The political speech, she thought, was the highest form of communication. Shakespeare might have had 2 or 3 hours in one of his plays to get his idea across. Hollywood tried the same thing in much the same time. Not her. She had 15 minutes at the bottom end, and maybe 45 at the top, and her ideas had to count. They had to sway the average citizen, the seasoned Paul, and the most cynical reporter. She studied her subject, and she was studying Ryan now, playing and replaying the few words he'd said on the night of his accession, then the TV spots the next morning. She watched his eyes and his gestures, his tension and intensity, his posture and body language. She liked what she saw in the abstract sense. Ryan was a man she'd trust as an investment advisor, for example. But he had a lot to learn about being a politician, and somebody had to teach him. Or maybe not, she wondered. Maybe, by not being a politician. Win or lose, it would be fun. For the first time, fun, not work. Nobody wanted to admit it, but she was one of the most perceptive of the people working here. Fowler had known that, and so had Durling, which was why they put up with her eccentricities. The senior political staff hated her, treated her as a useful but minor functionary, and seethed at how she could stroll across the street and go right into the Oval Office, because the president trusted her as he trusted few others. That had finally occasioned a comment suggesting that the president had a rather special reason for calling her over. And, after all, people from her part of the country were known to be a little loose when it came to... She wondered if he'd managed to get it up lately. The agent had pulled her hands off the little prick's face, but he'd been too slow to contain her knee. It hadn't even made the papers. Arnie had explained to him that a return to the center of power would be impeded by a charge of sexual misconduct, and then blacklisted him anyway. She liked Arnie. She liked the speech, too. 4 hours instead of the 3 she'd promised. A lot of effort for 12 minutes and 30 seconds. She tended to write them a little short because presidents had a way of speaking slowly. Most did. Ryan would have to learn that. She typed Control-P to print up the speech in Helvetica 14-point, 3 copies. Some political pukes would look things over and try to make corrections. That wasn't as much a problem now as it had been. When the printer stopped, she collated the pages, stapled them together, and lifted her phone. The topmost speed dial button went to the proper desk across the street. "Weston to see the boss," she told the appointment secretary. "Come right over." And with that, everything was as it should be. God had not heard her prayers, Mahudi saw. Well, the odds had been against that. Mixing his Islamic faith with scientific knowledge was as much a problem for the doctor as for his Christian and pagan colleagues. The Congo had been exposed to Christianity for over 100 years, but the old animistic beliefs still prospered, and that made it easier for Mahudi to despise them. It was the old question, if God were a God of mercy, then why did injustice happen? That might have been a good question to discuss with his imam, but for now it was enough that such things did happen, even to the just. They were called petechiae, a scientific name for blotches of subcutaneous bleeding, which showed up very plainly on her pale North European skin. Just as well that these nuns didn't use mirrors, thought a vanity in their religious universe, and one more thing for Mahudi to admire, though he didn't quite understand that particular fixation. Better that she should not see the red blotches on her face. They were unsightly all by themselves, but worse than that, they were the harbingers of death. Her fever was 40.2 now, and would have been higher still but for the ice in her armpits and behind her neck. Her eyes were listless. Her body pulled down with induced fatigue. Those were symptoms of many ailments, but the petechia told him that she was bleeding internally. Ebola was a hemorrhagic fever, one of a group of diseases that broke down tissue at a very basic level, allowing blood to escape everywhere within the body, which could only lead to cardiac arrest from insufficient blood volume. That was the killing mechanism, though how it came about, the medical world had yet to learn. There was no stopping it now. Roughly 20% of the victims did survive. Somehow their immune systems managed to rally and defeat the viral invader. How that happened was one more unanswered question. That it would not happen in this case was a question asked and answered. He touched her wrist to take the pulse, and even through his gloves the skin was hot and dry and slack. It was starting already. The technical term was systemic necrosis. The body had already started to die. The liver first, probably. For some reason, not understood, Ebola had a lethal affinity for that organ. Even the survivors had to deal with lingering liver damage. But one didn't live long enough to die from that, because all the organs were dying, some more rapidly than others, but soon all at once. The pain was as ghastly as it was invisible. Maudi wrote an order to increase the morphine drip. At least they could attenuate the pain, which was good for the patient and a safety measure for the staff. A tortured patient would thrash about, and that was a risk for those around a fever victim with a blood-borne disease and widespread bleeding. As it was, her left arm was restrained to protect the IV needle. Even with that precaution, the IV looked iffy at the moment, and starting another would be both dangerous and difficult to achieve, so degraded was her arterial tissue. Sister Maria Magdalena was attending her friend, her face covered, but her eyes sad. Maudi looked at her, and she at him, surprised to see sympathy on his face. Maudi had a reputation for coldness. "Pray with her, sister. There are things I must do now." And swiftly. He left the room, stripping off his protective garb as he did so, and depositing it in the proper containers. All needles used in this building went into special sharps containers for certain destruction. The casual African attitude toward those precautions had resulted in the first major Ebola outbreak in 1976. That strain was called Ebola Mayinga, after a nurse who had contracted the virus, probably through carelessness. They'd learned better since, but Africa was still Africa. Back in his office, he made another call. Things would begin to happen now. He wasn't sure what exactly, though he'd helped determine whatever they were, and he did that by commencing an immediate literature search for something useless. "I'm going to save you." The remark made Ryan laugh and Price wince. Arnie just turned his head to look at her. The chief of staff took note of the fact that she still didn't dress the part. That was actually a plus point for the Secret Service, who called the sartorially endowed staffers peacocks, which was more polite than other things they might have said. Even the secretary spent more on clothes than Callie Weston did. Arnie just held his hand out. "Here you go." President Ryan was quietly grateful for the large type. He wouldn't have to wear his glasses or disgrace himself by telling somebody to increase the size of the printing. Normally a fast reader, he took his time on this document. "One change," he said after a moment. "What's that?" Weston asked suspiciously. "We have a new secretary, George Winston."
"The zillionaire?"
Ryan flipped the first page. "Well, I could have picked a bum off a park bench, but I thought somebody with knowledge of the financial markets might be a good idea." "We call them homeless people, Jack," Arnie pointed out. "Or I could have chosen an academic, but Buzz Fiedler would have been the only one I'd trust," Jack went on soberly, remembering again. A rare academic, Fiedler, a man who knew what he didn't know. Damn. "This is good, Miss Weston." Van Damme got to page 3. Callie. Arnie, baby, you don't write Olivier for George C. Scott. You write Olivier for Olivier, and Scott for Scott. In her heart, Callie Weston knew that she could hop a flight from Dulles to LAX, rent a car, go to Paramount, and in 6 months she'd have a house in the Hollywood Hills, a Porsche to drive to her reserved parking place off Melrose Boulevard, and that gold-plated computer. But no. All the world might be a stage, but the part she wrote for was the biggest and the brightest. The public might not know who she was, but she knew that her words changed the world.
"So what am I exactly?" the president asked, looking up.
"You're different. I told you that."
Chapter 12. Presentation. There were few aspects of life more predictable, Ryan thought. He'd had a light dinner so that his stomach flutters would not be too painful, and largely ignored his family as he read and reread the speech. He'd made a few penciled changes, almost all of them minor linguistic things to which Callie had not objected, and which she herself modified further. The speech had been transmitted electronically to the secretary's room off the Oval Office. Callie was a writer, not a typist, and the presidential secretaries could type at a speed that made Ryan gasp to watch. When the final draft was complete, it was printed on paper for the president to hold, while another version was electronically uploaded onto the teleprompter. Callie Weston was there to be sure that both versions were exactly the same. It was not unknown for someone to change one from the other at the last minute. But Weston knew about that and guarded her work like a lioness over newborn cubs. But the predictably awful part came from Van Damme.
"Jack, this is the most important speech you will ever give. Just relax and do it."
"Gee, thanks, Arnie."
The chief of staff was a coach who'd never really played the game, and expert as he was, he just didn't know what it was like to go out on the mound and face the batters. The cameras were being set up, a primary and a backup, the latter almost never used, both of them with teleprompters. The blazing TV lights were in place, and for the period of the speech the president would be silhouetted in his office windows like a deer on a ridgeline, one more thing for the Secret Service to worry about, though they had confidence in the windows, which were specced to stop a 50-caliber machine gun round. The TV crews were all known to the detail, who checked them out anyway, along with the equipment. Everyone knew it was coming. The evening TV shows had made the necessary announcements, then moved on to other news items. It was all a routine exercise, except to the president, of course, for whom it was all new and vaguely horrifying. He'd expected the phone to ring, but not at this hour. Only a few had the number of his cellular. It was too dangerous to have a real number for a real hardwired phone. The Mossad was still in the business of making people disappear. The newly found peace in the Middle East hadn't changed that, and truly they had reason to dislike him. They'd been particularly clever in killing a colleague through his cellular phone, first disabling it via electronic signal, and then arranging for him to get a substitute, with 10 grams of high explosive tucked into the plastic. The man's last phone message, or so the story went, had come from the head of the Mossad. "Hello, this is Avi Ben Yaakov. Listen closely, my friend." At which point the Jew had thumbed the number key. A clever ploy, but good only for a single play. The trilling note caused his eyes to open with a curse. He'd gone to bed only an hour earlier.
"Yes?" "Call Yusif."
And the circuit went dead. As a further security measure, the call had come through several cutouts, and the message itself was too short to give much opportunity to the electronic intelligence wizards in the employ of his numerous enemies. The final measure was more clever still. He immediately dialed yet another cellular number and repeated the message he'd just heard. A clever enemy who might have tracked the message through the cellular frequencies would probably have deemed him just another cutout. Or maybe not. The security games one had to play in this modern age were a genuine drag on day-to-day life, and one could never know what worked and what did not, until one died of natural causes, which was hardly worth waiting for. Grumbling all the more, he rose and dressed and walked outside. His car was waiting. The third cutout had been his driver. Together with two guards, they drove to a secure location, a safe house in a safe place. Israel might be at peace, and even the PLO might have become part of a democratically elected regime. Was the world totally mad? But Beirut was still a place where all manner of people could operate. The proper signal was displayed there. It was the pattern of lighted and unlighted windows, showing that it was safe for him to exit the car and enter the building. Or so he'd find out in 30 seconds or so. He was too drowsy to care. Fear became boring after a lifetime of it. There was the expected cup of coffee, bittersweet and strong, on the plain wooden table. Greetings were exchanged, seats taken, and conversation begun. "It is late." "My flight was delayed," his host explained. "We require your services." "For what purpose?" "One might call it diplomacy," was the surprising answer. He went on to explain. 10 minutes, the president heard. More makeup. It was 8:20. Ryan was in place. Mary Abbott applied the finishing touches to his hair, which merely increased the feeling that Ryan was an actor instead of a politician. No, not that. He refused to accept the label, no matter what Arnie or any of the others might say. Through the open door to his right, Callie Weston stood by the secretary's desk, giving him a smile and a nod to mask her own unease. She had written a masterpiece. She always felt that way. And now it would be delivered by a rookie. Mrs. Abbott walked around to the front of the desk, occulting some of the TV lights to look at her work from the perspective of the viewer, and pronounced it good. Ryan merely sat there and tried not to fidget, knowing that soon he'd start sweating under the makeup again, and that it would itch like a son of a bitch, and that he couldn't scratch at it no matter what, because presidents didn't itch or scratch. There were probably people out there who didn't think that presidents had to use the toilet, or shave, or maybe even tie their shoes. 5 minutes, sir. Mic check. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, Ryan said dutifully. Thank you, Mr. President, the director called from the next room. Ryan had occasionally wondered about this sort of thing. Presidents delivering these official statements, a tradition going back at least as far as FDR and his fireside chats, which he'd first heard about from his mother, always seemed confident and at ease, and he'd always wondered how they ever managed to bring that off. He felt neither. One more layer of tension for him. The cameras were probably on now, so that the directors could be sure they were working. And somewhere a tape machine was recording the look on his face and the way his hands were playing with the papers in front of him. He wondered if the Secret Service had control of that tape, or whether they trusted the TV people to be honorable about such things. Surely their own anchor people occasionally tipped over their coffee cups, or sneezed, or snarled at an assistant who messed up right before airtime. Oh yes, those taped segments were called bloopers, weren't they? He was willing to bet, right there, right then, that the service had a lengthy tape of presidential miscues. 2 minutes. Both cameras had teleprompters. These were odd contraptions. A TV set actually hung from the front of each camera. But on those small sets, the picture was inverted left to right, because just above it was a tilted mirror. The camera lens was behind the mirror, shooting through it, while on it the president saw the text of his speech reflected. It was an otherworldly feeling talking to a camera you couldn't really see to millions of people who weren't really there. He'd actually be talking to his speech, as it were. Ryan shook his head as the speech text was fast-tracked to make sure the scrolling system worked. 1 minute, stand by. Okay. Ryan adjusted himself in the seat. His posture worried him. Did he plant his arms on the desktop? Did he hold his hands in his lap? He'd been told not to lean back in the chair because it was both too casual and too arrogant-looking, but Ryan tended to move around a lot, and holding still made his back hurt. Or was it something he just imagined? A little late for that now. He noted the fear, the twisting heat in his stomach. He tried to belch and then stifled it. 15 seconds. Fear almost became panic. He couldn't run away now. He had to do the job. This was important. People depended on him. Behind each camera was an operator. There were 3 Secret Service agents to watch over them. A director assistant was there as well. They were his only audience, but he could barely make them out, hidden as they were in the glare of the lights, and they wouldn't react anyway. How would he know what his real audience thought? Oh, shit. A minute earlier, network anchors had come on to tell people what they already knew. Their evening TV shows would be put back a time for a presidential address. Across the country, an indeterminate number of people lifted their controllers to switch to a cable channel as soon as they saw the great seal of the President of the United States of America. Ryan took a deep breath, compressed his lips, and looked into the nearer of the 2 cameras. The red light went on. He counted to 2 and began.
Good evening. My fellow Americans, I'm taking this time to report to you on what has been happening in Washington for the past week, and to tell you about what will be happening over the next few days. First of all, the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Department of Justice, assisted by the Secret Service, the National Transportation Safety Board, and other federal agencies, have taken the lead in investigating the circumstances surrounding the tragic deaths of so many of our friends. With praiseworthy assistance from the Japanese National Police and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Full information will be released this evening, and will be in your morning papers. For now, I will give you the results of the investigation to date. The crash of the Japan Airlines 747 into the Capitol building was the deliberate act of one man. His name was Torajiro Sato. He was a senior captain with that airline. We've learned quite a lot about Captain Sato. We know that he lost both a brother and a son during our conflict with his country. Evidently he was unbalanced by this, and decided, on his own, to take his revenge. After flying his airliner to Vancouver, Canada, Captain Sato faked a flight order to London, ostensibly to replace a disabled aircraft with his own. Prior to takeoff, Captain Sato murdered his co-pilot in cold blood, a man with whom he had worked for several years. He then continued on entirely alone, the whole time with a dead man strapped in the seat next to him. Ryan paused, his eyes tracking the words on the mirror. His mouth felt like raw cotton as a cue on the teleprompter told him to turn the page. Okay, how can we be sure of this? First, the identities of both Captain Sato and his co-pilot have been verified by the FBI using DNA testing. Separate tests conducted by the Japanese National Police have produced identical results. An independent laboratory checked these tests with their own, and again the results were the same. The possibility of a mistake in these tests is virtually zero. The other flight crew members who remained in Vancouver have been interviewed both by the FBI and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and they are certain that Captain Sato was aboard the aircraft. We have similar eyewitness reports from local officials of the Canadian Ministry of Transport and from American passengers on the flight. More than 50 people have positively identified him. We have Captain Sato's fingerprints on the bogus flight plan. Voice print analysis of the cockpit tapes also confirms the pilot's identity. There is, therefore, no question of the identity of the flight crew of the aircraft. Second, the cockpit tapes from the aircraft's flight recorder give us an exact time for the first murder. We even have